I just want to start this podcast by, I was thinking about it, and Bri, he's got in touch with me and he said he's loving these podcasts because he started retelling some of the stories now and it sort of rejuvenated him a bit. And I was thinking about the two people I've ridden bikes with, once with Dickie Hanlon, when we were 19 to Spain, and then with Bri across to Oz. And the factor with both of these guys, apart from them both being called Richard, because Bri's middle name is Richard, and both being born in the first week of June like me, it's kind of bizarre. They had resilience and they were used to just making do, you know, like neither of these dudes complained. Like we did some pretty hard shit and it's just that, yeah, let's just make do. And I think that's from the upbringing, like you just got used to just making do. And yeah, it's a good trait because then you're pretty happy when you get the smallest things. Okay, we're rolling. On our way to Darwin, we took a couple of days stopover in Bali. Walking down Leggian Street, and prostitutes are shouting after us, obscenities. They drifted in and out of the shadowed shop doorways of Leggian Street, or zoomed around on their mopeds, ferrying tourists back to their rooms. Kuta Bali was the Indonesian Ibiza for Australians. You want massage, t-shirt, drink, woman, boy, marijuana, heroin? Bali is a Hindu island. The Balinese blame most of the sleaze on the Javanese. The bad girl, Javanese, the thief, Javanese, come here to make money. A guy introduced himself as an artist from Surabaya in Java. He looked like an ancient gigolo, his prized hair falling out, and though he tried to appear friendly, you could just tell in his eyes, it's just, there's no light. He was looking for work here with his cousin, a girl he introduced to me. She was a secretary and looking for work too. She smiled. Did I want to come for a coffee? When I said no, the man pretended to walk to the cafe, but shortly afterwards stopped and introduced himself to someone else. At the Sari Club entrance, an Aussie guy had his head stuffed into a conifer tree and was eating it. He pulled his face out, slugged some beer, had another chew, and then burped in my face. Street hawkers opened their boxes of counterfeit watches and the stall owners called out for trade. Bri used his typical charms to meet a Javanese girl and they went up into the lookout tower on the beach to check the waves at night. The next day, Bri had forgotten he was arranged to meet her and he'd forgotten where she was staying. So we sat on the beach, on the wall by the beach, just watching the early morning beach vendors, like the people who did the massage and sell you drinks and trinkets, cleaning up the beach, getting cigarette butts out. Right, so this episode is going to be a bit full on in places. I've been reading through this and there's a lot of interesting and crazy stuff to let out and sad stuff in places. So in 1971, one of the greatest waves in Bali was discovered when they were filming a movie called Morning of the Earth, a surf movie. Uluwatu was found, and it means Ulu, which is land's end, and Watu, which means rock. It's a reef break down on the Bucket Peninsula, which is the southern end of Bali. So they went to make this movie, and this break is gnarly. Like, super reef break, holds up to 20-foot waves. Guy called Albie Falzon was one of the movie makers. He lives just down the road from us here in Coffs. He once surfed past me at this break down the coast. He'd waited out the back for hours, and he just screeched through on the best wave of the day on his mail. Just totally stoked on the wave. It's good to see. Back in the 70s, there was no roads. You had to sort of bash your way through to this cliff, like a limestone or sandstone. I think sandstone cliffs. And then climb down the cliffs and out through a cave to paddle out. Above the break, there's a Hindu temple hanging off the cliff edge, smothered in green monkeys and vines. Problem was, the film opened the floodgates to surfers, including me, I guess. From all over the world, people came there, and Bali is wedged up with overdevelopment, tourist saturation and plastic waste. The money draws in traders, thieves, scammers, gold diggers, gangsters, you name it, from neighbouring islands, because it's big money. And unfortunately, even though they've got strict laws there, there's quite a lot of corruption. Like, you get frisked up pretty often by cops for money. Like, you get on a moped and ride to a surf break, which I'd done later, and cops would stop you. Oh, yeah, come on. Tell you you have to give them a few thousand rupiah. So a lot of the surf breaks are on the Bucket Peninsula in Bali, where it picks up the swell. And Kuta is above it, further north. And it's like, if you imagine like a lump hammer, and you hold it by the handle upside down, so the base is at the bottom, the peninsula is at the bottom, and the Kuta's, and say it's all facing north, east, south, west. The west side is where Padang Padang is and Uluwatu, and on the handle bit on the west side is where Kuta is. So that's actually not on the peninsula. Okay, geez, I'm recording again already. Nowadays, Bali is just as dangerous and crazy, super busy. And a lot of people go there because of the allegedly more relaxed lifestyle than on the more stricter Muslim islands. But I don't know, I think they're clamping down here because people are just going nuts. Apparently a tourist dies every 9 days in Bali from either drowning, moped rides, drugs, overdoses, drinking bad alcohol. Because 50% of the alcohol over there is fake, homemade stuff, and it's got methanol in it. And you can die from poisoning. Apparently the antidote to that is drinking pure vodka, like from a duty-free place where you know it's not been homemade, and it somehow equalizes and rids the body of the other stuff. Look that up if you ever get in that situation. Aussies are probably the most people who go there, about 20,000 a week. But now there's a ton of Ukrainians and Russians running there from escaping the war. And some people have filmed themselves naked in sacred places, and now Bali's like just had enough and they're banning people from going to the tops of mountains and to the sacred trees, fig trees and various places. I think as a purist traveller, you know, if you kind of get in the grain of it and you understand the culture a bit, you don't understand it a lot, but you understand it more than just rocking up and demanding bacon and eggs like we would have done in Spain and Greece, you cringe at the way people use these places. But I guess it's a reciprocal agreement that the money comes in and then they have to put up with all these people strutting around in G-strings drinking too much grog and acting like idiots. When COVID was on, Bali tried to clean up a lot of the crap that the tourists had generated, all the plastic straws, plastic this, plastic that. And some even went back to farming, like farming the seaweed and some of the traditional ways that were being forgotten because it sold out to tourism. They were saying as well that a lot of the hotels are owned by overseas companies, so a lot of the locals don't own much, and it's the overseas people who are creaming the money and profits. There's a guy, I've got a website, by the way, now. I've got an Instagram account now. It's called Richo, Tales from the Ute. If you put that in, it should come up. And I'll put some links in there. There's one which is this guy's, I think he's called Paul Bench. If I've got that wrong, I'll change it. But he's cleaning up Bali, like he's just attacking rivers and just cleaning out all the plastics and putting in these barriers to catch any plastics that come down. And hopefully that sense is coming through with the younger people and we're going to clean up these places. Because you go surfing and you just get wrapped in plastic. The guy who's cleaning up Bali and other parts of Indonesia with his crew is called Gary Bench, E-G-H-I-B. And I've put his link on my Richo Tales from the Ute Instagram page. Bloody amazing. He's just getting shit done. There's a big understatement in Southeast Asia with drugs. Like I've said previously, Brian and me weren't really that much into drugs because we were riding as bikes. And I'll tell you a story a bit later on where I give my bike away and then things go pear-shaped. But I've met a lot of people. Like I was in the Philippines and a guy's smoking dope in the room I'm in. And he's blowing it out the window and he's saying, do you want a bit of this? Just like saying, do you want a drink of a beer? And you can get put in prison for like 5 or 10 years just for that. So surely the anxiety of getting caught counteracts the chill you get from smoking dope. It's crazy. The president now in the Philippines. So Southeast Asia has the death penalty for drug trafficking and drug offences. You get high prison terms. Half the countries that have death penalties are in Southeast Asia. Like Indonesia, Malaysia, Singapore, Vietnam, Laos, Thailand. And Aussies have been up against a firing squad there. There was a girl who took 4 kgs of marijuana to Bali in a board bag and got caught, and she ended up doing, she got sentenced for 20 years in prison in Bali. And there's, in Indonesia, there's 150 people on death row, mostly for drug crimes, and 50 of those are international, like overseas people. The Philippines president, you've probably heard about it, but he's kind of got vigilante groups and his soldiers gunning down thousands of traffickers and people who were involved with drugs in the Philippines. There was, it's ironic because Southeast Asia had one of the highest exports of methamphetamine, as I mentioned before. So maybe that's why. Maybe that they can see it at the source. And it's harder to control when there's the money, so the stakes are so high. Like, they just make so much more than an average person. It's, you know, you see your family suffering, or you can't afford medical, you can't afford to see a doctor for your family or your kids, and then there's this drug option. So I guess there's more temptation and it's harder to control. I was chatting to a mate about smoking dope in Southeast Asia, and he told me that him and his mate they'd bought some gear. They'd got these Thai sticks, which are literally pure cigars made out of leaf and bud, rolled into like a cigar, or sometimes they're on like a skewer. It's like some sort of satay stick, but it's all buds. And yeah, they got some of these. They were working their way through them. This Matt guy said, "Oh, you take the rest. I'm off now." And he travelled from Thailand through Malaysia, through Singapore, and through quite a part of Indonesia. And he found, later on, he found in his bag this dope. And the guy had put it in one of the pockets. It was probably enough to get him at least 5 years in prison. Just gnarly. But on the flip side of that, magic mushrooms are sold in like coffee carts in Bali. They're totally illegal. I mean, comparatively, mushrooms can send you to funny places if you take too much, and you need to have good solid friends around you, and you need to be in the right headspace, and you need to take the right dosage. Whereas all these manufactured drugs, no one knows what's in them. So, and I'm not telling you anything new, but there is a story coming up when my doppelganger was acting stupid and took a pill and, yeah, didn't go down too well. Okay, I'm going to duck out for a quick paddle. Just before that, this is an add-in for the drugs one. There was a couple of students from Singapore. They came to Australia, got a bit loose, partied, got handed some spliffs at a party, smoked some dope. When they went back to Singapore, they must have been, I don't know if it's immigration, must have been immigration. They gave them blood tests, found out they had THC in the blood, because apparently it lasts for, I think it's 28 days in your blood. And they got either fined or put in prison for a short period for smoking something outside of Singapore. So that just lets you know the severity of smoking stuff. One of the guys from work, Mark, he prompted me about Thailand and the drug changes in the laws. And I knew that we're allowing pharmaceutical marijuana, but now recreational marijuana's fully legal. And it's just gone ballistic. Like 2,000 shops popped up in a very short period of time. And they had applications to grow marijuana, and there was 9 million applications. Because I think 30% of the population there are chawners, farmers, chawna. And they're like, oh yeah, get into that act, get a bit of extra cash. But problem is now there's lollies and all these little sweets that kids are chewing on. And apparently it's the dosage that gives you psychosis. So if you overdose on it, like have too much THC, then you're going to spiral. So it's kind of a bit messed up now. It's kind of gone from war to go real quick, from when you could get in prison to when you can just grow it and buy it in a shop. Well, I'm rolling again. Jesus! Okay, here we go. In about... So Brian and me were about to leave this place, and the drunken, yobbo, thoughtless, fucking meat shop, you know, like meat factory type, carry on with these clubs. It was just... It's just too much like back home, I guess. And just drunken fools wanting to fight you. All that testosterone and poses. You know, there was no real... It wasn't real. And we just watched it go out the back of the BMO window as we caught a BMO to the airport and we flew to Australia, Darwin. But I just wanted to tell a story of when I went back there, because I ended up back there a couple of times later on. I went back and traveled through Asia for 7 months on my own. Started with my old man. My old man came with me for a bit, but after Bali, he'd had enough. Took him to a hostel in Timor, and it was like a dollar a night, and there was like shit and blood, squash mosquitoes on the walls, these little grungy beds. And after a while, he realized that I was just living too under the poverty line for my dad's taste. And we flew to Bali. I hooked up with some mates, a good mate of mine called Lee. And we went surfing in Lombok with a few of us. So that was then. And then a few years later, I'd gone back to Oz and I'd met the love of my life. But I was torn between giving up traveling, like it'd been 3 years. So I had this great idea that I'd go back to Indo for just a few weeks, and then maybe she could come out with me, and then for a couple of weeks, and then we could go back. And but she had kids already, and I was 32 by then, and it went pear-shaped. So I'm out in, went to Lombok to meet my mate Lee again. He was a bit of a cocaine head back in England, spending over £1,000 a week on coke. Lee used to call cocaine the devil's dandruff. We climbed a mountain and he had a massive detox. We climbed Mount Rinjani in Lombok, it's over 3,000 meters, 3,700 meters. And we got almost to the top of that and he was swelling up with all the shit coming out of his body. I was going to ride a push bike around Lombok and surf, pick up all the quiet surf breaks away from the crowds. But in the end, I said, no, I'm going back. I'm going to try and retrieve my relationship back in Australia. So I gave my bike and the pannier bags to this local surfer, Jacko, which would have been handy for him getting supplies back and forth from the markets. And Lee flew back. We went back to Bali. Lee flew out back to the UK. And I was on the peninsula in Bali, on the Bucket Peninsula, staying at a place called Padang Padang. I was really at the crossroads. It's a real Peter Pan moment. I remembered the other guys who I'd spoke about before, who I'd met. You know, this was 2 and a bit years after, or more actually, about 3 years after, or 4 years after I'd met some of those perpetual travelers. And I was really felt I was at that moment at the crossroads. I was staying at Padang Padang. It was a lot quieter then. What was that, like 29 years after the Surfer had made the movie there? And you used to have to go down these steps between a crack in the cliffs to get down to the beach. And on the beach, there was in the corner there, in the northern corner of the beach, there was just one like bamboo shack on stilts, like a, and you could keep there for $1 a night. You sort of like kept on these little bamboo beds, and there was a blanket or a sheet between, like a sarongs between each bed. Pretty basic. And fragile lady called Wayan, she ran the place. There's a naming code in Bali which you might know of. It's like it was Wayan Madde Nayoman Katut. So if you're the first kid, you're Wayan. If you're the second kid, like me, you're Madde. If you're third, Nayoman. Fourth, Katut. I'm not sure what after that. Anyway, she was called Wayan. In her 50s, I guess. Mid-50s. And she was a real cackling character. Teeth missing. And she went, she's a bit out there. And on high tide, like the whole place shook. Like it was, you have to do a runner to get up through a crack in the cliffs. And I was staying there one day and I was underneath, sheltering from the sun, having a shave. And I got to know all the locals because I could speak I could speak Bahasa Indonesia, like, quite a bit. So I got a good relationship with the locals. And someone shouted, Reg, quick! So I ran out from under the thing. I'm still shaving. I came out and there's a guy drowning in the water. This guy in his 50s, swept out along up against the cliffs, out toward the break, Padang Padang. And the I snorkeled under there once, and it's, hey up. I snorkeled under there once, and it's all like lava tubes and urchins, super shallow at the back where the waves break, and you can get super messed up. It's a perfect left-hander, solid as the, bit above my pay grade, to be fair. So I look out, and this guy's battling the current. Because just for anyone who doesn't understand rips, the water comes in and then it's got to find a way back out to sea. And they form rips like rivers, and they're often by the cliffs, by the edge, and it just swirls round and it's like a river. And this guy's trying to swim against this current. And I'm like, fuck. So I'm not thinking straight, and I just drop my razor and mirror and just run across and dive across the shallow rocks and swim out to him. And then I realized, bad idea. Like, it was a dumb move, because if you go out to try and save someone without any flotation, they can just panic and jump on you and drown you. So you need to pass them some form of flotation and try and calm them down. And just swimming out, I had nothing. I've saved a few people from drowning. Two were really easy, and one was really hard. But this guy was one of the easier ones. I looked at him and I said, don't panic. You're in the rip, man. Come this way, come this way. And just when I turned around, and an Indonesian local had paddled out with two surfboards. Just that alone was brilliant. And then he gave me one for myself and gave me one to give to this guy. So I just handed one to the guy, told him to get on it, and then I told him to grab my feet, and I paddled him back across the rip and to shore. And he sat on the sand, like I say, he's probably about 50 odd. He's going bald. He's from South America. he's around 50, and we're sat on the sand, and he's recovering, getting his breath back. And he's saying, I'm a good swimmer. I'm trying to explain, yes, but you're swimming against a river, and eventually you'll stop swimming, and the river won't stop running. So it's energy versus energy. You're not going to survive. But he said, he started reeling off everywhere he's been. I traveled the world many years. I've been here, I've been there, I've been over here, there, every country you could think of. And right at the end, he said, maybe next year I'll get married. And I was at the crossroads, and I just looked at this balding guy with a paunch in his 50s, and I just thought, fuck, that's going to be me. When Lee went home, and I got rid of my bike, I just had my surfboard, so I was staying at Padang Padang, and I hooked up with this Swiss guy who was a Rasta, who smoked a lot of weed, and this other girl who was a ex-heroin addict, but I didn't realize it at the time. And we'd gone into town. I said, oh, let's party. And we had one excellent night. So I said, let's do it again. So we went in again. And I reckon it was one of the dumbest things I've done. We ended up at this locals only place. And we went in. And the first thing was Rasta man, Rasta Swiss. He got ripped off trying to buy some dope. Someone took his money, and he didn't come back. So we're in this club, and it's pitch black with these strobe lights and just an occasional light going on, and the music's just that heavy, heavy bang. It's just... I'm looking around, and people are dancing, but people are mashed. Like, in the shadows, someone's handed me a pill, and I took this pill, and I know you've got to experience things yourselves, but just anybody who's young, please learn by my mistakes, because I reckon it was either had tranquilizers in it, or fucking fentanyl, or heroin, or I don't know what was in it, but I start tripping straight away, and then, actually, I can't tell it like that. Yeah, so we're in this club, and the music's just, and it's locals only. There's not one tourist in there apart from me and this Rasta guy, and someone, it obviously wasn't me, but someone who looked just like me, probably my doppelganger, took a pill and off this guy. And he's dancing in this club and starts shaking. The whole club's going nuts, like, but in a frantic, desperate way. Like, I see this guy, and I ask him how many pills he's had, and he's shaking. And he goes, digger, digger, digger. And he's like about to fucking implode, like he needs to go to hospital. And down on the floor, people are just keeled over, like fucking comatosed. Rasta man's pissed off, so we come out of this club, and we get, I think he's got a moped. I think he's riding a moped, and we end up back at Padang Padang. But it's early, so I'm still buzzing after this nightclub and my doppelganger incident. And it actually starts getting daylight, And I'm down on the beach. I walk back down through the crack in the cliffs. And I get to the bamboo shack. And I'm not on the same... I'm not in normality land, if you know what I'm saying. And Wyan's in this little bathtub naked at the bottom of the steps on the way up to this bamboo shack because she's not expecting anyone to rock up at sort of 5 a.m. And she's... She's going, oh, you'll see me naked. Oh! She's covering herself up, doing this gappy smile at me. And I'm like, whoa, whoa. And I wander down onto the shoreline and I'm tripping all over the place. And I think I'd gone in and got my journal and I'm trying to write. And I'm just super paranoid. And fishermen are looking at me like, oh, not another idiot. And I just felt like a complete fucking waster. And I went back. By then, I'd actually moved up from the shack. There was another little place up the top, and I was staying up there. And the whole day, I laid in bed, holding my head. I thought my head was going to explode. That night, I went to the bridge, and I could see things. I could see, like, ancient local... ceremonies happening in the forest with people around fires with all the Balinese headbands on and whispering in the quiet village of voices. And I had, this is 24 hours later and I'm like still getting visuals. The girl who was used to be a heroin addict is telling me I'm a lightweight and it's no big deal and all this, but I feel like my brain's actually being eaten away. I feel I'm being destroyed. And I just can't believe my stupidity because I'm not a drug taker. Like, my doppelganger was, of course, but not me. But I can't believe the stupidity because probably a handful of times that kind of thing has occurred to my doppelganger. But, yeah, dumbest move in my life and... definitely put the brakes on. I'm still stuck in this cyclic loop that doesn't seem to want to leave my body. I'm trying to poop it out, trying to drink it, pee it out. I'm squatting the toilet. It's just, get out of me, you bastard, get out of me, fuck, fuck. And I'm going back to the room and I'm like, all these visuals. And then I've got the hallucinations with the tribal guys. And then, well, my doppelganger has. I'm telling it in the form of my doppelganger. And then I just said to my doppelganger, you got to run. You got to run. So doppelganger just starts running. And he runs from Padang Padang to Uluwatu. And back then it was peaceful, like it wasn't built up. And there was all these cows up on the rise. And you could just hear the wooden bells clinking. Like a Swiss wooden bell on all this cattle. I got to Uluwatu and the moon came out and it was slightly raining and I started doing like, my doppelganger. I could have been doing it next to my doppelganger because doing yoga and exercise isn't illegal. So we're doing all this yoga, press-ups, pull-ups on this shelter. Me and Doppo, we went down through the caves in the dark with the moon out through the Uluwatu cave, down to the waves. Waves are washing in. It's like middle of the night. And climb back up, running around. I've even got this stick with me like I'm on this sort of shepherd on this pilgrimage. And then the rains really hit and it seemed to wash all this crap off me and doppelganger. All the bad shit that you'd be crazy to put in your body. You might as well just open the chemical cupboard under the sink and start slugging on some Domestos or something. And then there was this feeling of absolute calm amongst all these cowbells and the light rain and the steam. The road was steaming and all this stuff finally left the body. And then we walk back, me and Dopo, we walk back to the, I hope you guys understand who Dopo is. We walk back to the Padang Padang. And I had this great idea then. I was singing a song, like, singing the song of enlightenment I've written. I got the answer. I'm at the crossroads, but I know which way I'm going. I need to turn back to Oz and unburn that bridge with my sweetheart. Get home. So I'm walking back to this hostel going, I know the answer. I gotta find her. And I'm singing this song. I think it's in like a reggae beat as well. I know the answer. I gotta find her. I gotta return, man. I gotta do that. Don't mess it up again. And I'm making this song up. And I fly back to Australia, get home and offer all these trinkets and presents. And my partner, she's not having it. Next news, I get kicked out. I end up sleeping in a cave above Shelley Beach in Manly, brushing shoulders with all the hobos who live in the rocks and the caves there. So to recap, me and Bri were there in 96. Went back in 98 with my old man. Went off with Lee. Back in 2000 with Lee. Had the big crazy waiting for the plane to go back to Australia. Went to the dark side for a bit. And the doppelganger situation with the bad pill. But the night before that, I'd been down in Legian Street and I'd met Maddie, a local street guy, a guy who looks, he said, Saya lihat, I look. That was his job. Jeez, recording already. I sat down with this in Balinese guy, it's maybe in his early 40s, called Madde Jarmana. It was 3 a.m. and Maddie sat there, his little frame propped against the shop window, watching the street. Transport, his friends asked some Australians, and twirled an invisible steering wheel. Go away! The girl was drunk, graceless. The guy was holding her up by her ass, turned round. Piss off, transport. Orang bodoh sekali, I said. No problem, Mari said. They over there, me here. Smile, okay, go away. No problem. Mari looked up and down the street again. He told me that his job was varied. If a man wants, he was basically an agent for any sleaze on the street. If a man wants woman, transport, smoking, he was a connection. But it was light and it started raining. Business was slow. So we sat back and talked in the shop doorway. Made lived in Denpasar, the main city of Bali, about 12 k's away. He came here to earn his money. Every night he and his friends monitored the streets. He said there's hati hati, banyak disini. Like, lots of danger here. Danger that only he could see, not me. I couldn't differentiate. I only saw Indonesians and tourists. Made was from a small village in the north in the mountains. And eventually, after we had this great chat, he said that we could go there to see a ceremony of his family. At first he was unsure, it seemed a personal thing, but he thought about it and said, yes, you can come. And we talk about life, not money. And I could see the good in him. He's just been adapted to make money in this place and he's had to drop a few morals along the way. I never did go to the village. I got sick and something bad I bought on the street, i.e. the doppelganger bought the next day. I managed to get word to him and he forgave me, but I felt like a real phony. But I always think about Maddie because a couple of years later, there was a terrorist attack in that exact spot, just down from where Maddie used to sit, and 202 people got killed. There was a car bomb, a bomb in a van outside the Sari Club, and a suicide bomber went into Paddy's. A lot of innocent people got killed. It was in retaliation to the retaliation of 9/11. So when the Americans came down heavy on terrorism, then some terrorists from Malaysia came to Bali and just preyed on the soft targets of the innocent people. And there's actually something in the Quran that says you can't kill innocent people for the greater good. Because I follow a podcast called Conflicted, and this the Muslim presenter, he explains a section in the Quran where the Arabs were caught in a dilemma because the Mongolians were using, they would have been Persian, probably called them Persian back then. Apologies to anybody if I've said something wrong here. But they're basically, the Mongolians were using the captives to throw ladders up on the next fortress, and then they'd climb up and attack that fortress. And the people in that fortress didn't want to harm their own people who were being forced to put these ladders up. So there was a ruling made that they could, for the greater good, kill the innocents. But it didn't extend to just innocent people in the street. And like I said, I don't really want to get into any religious aspect from any angle. So I'll just leave it at that.